is to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. How do you turn an ordinary get-together into something deeper, maybe even transformative?
My husband and I, when we first moved to the city, we wanted to explore it. We started this experiment where one Saturday a month, we would spend 12 hours off our phones in a neighborhood. 12 hours.
This is Priya Parker.
Friends started to join, and we kind of organically came up with some rules that worked. You have to show up on time and stay the whole time. Commit to one conversation over meals with everybody else, and be willing to submit to the host. And the host would rotate and would plan the day. Walking around in a city, getting bagels or bringing your lunch, there are ways to have beautiful, meaningful experiences that are not extraordinarily expensive. Spending 12 hours together as a group was fundamentally different than spending 3 hours together four times. Groups warm up together, you cool down together, and every time around 2 p.m. people would start getting tired or cranky or run out of things to say. And actually, that's when the real conversation would start. I mean, we gather all the time, right? We gather for baby showers, we gather for back to school nights, we gather in the classroom and board meetings and conferences, at funerals, at weddings. And what I think is actually important more than ever is that we need to gather well.
Priya Parker is on a one-woman mission to reform the way we get together. In person, not online. Real conversations, not just catching up. More adventure, more ceremony, more meaning. So, I used to love having people over for dinner, spending a whole Saturday shopping and cooking and setting the table. But gradually, I just stopped. I don't know why. It feels like I don't have the time or the energy to host gatherings anymore. Well, Priya Parker thinks that there is an art to gathering, and that it begins by ditching all the old social scripts and stale routines. What would that even look like? Priya told Shannon Henry Kleiber about a gathering that transformed her a long time ago.
When I was 11 or whatever age it was, I got my period. I was at a friend's house when it happened, and I had read that Judy Blume book, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret.
Oh, yeah, sure.
But otherwise wasn't totally sure whether this was a good thing, whether this was a bad thing, whether there's something I should hide, whether it's something I should share. I went home, and I told my mother, and she picked me up in the air, and she swung me around, and she started hooping and hollering all over the house with joy. Then she said, I'm going to host a period party for you. And she invited 6 women, not my friends, so her friends, and she invented this ritual, this gathering, and all of them brought me presents and gifts of what they most loved being a woman. She played Peter, Paul, and Mary and Michael Jackson. I mean, literally, this whole thing is kind of made up. But I will remember, and I did remember for the rest of my life, that to be a woman is something that is to be celebrated.
That's a beautiful story. Wow. Well, so many of us aspire to having more dinner parties and having friends over, having this house where, you know, people are coming and going and always welcome. But then we think, oh, we have to clean the house. We have to cook the right food. We have to.
Right.
You know, you start to almost talk yourself out of having a dinner party.
Yes.
How can we be better at that?
How can we lower the barriers to entry?
Yes.
To gather meaningfully? So what I'm arguing against is sort of the Martha Stewart school of you have to have the right fish knives, or you have to have prepare the crudités in the right way, or you have to, you know, have the perfect foraged ramps or the Georgian wine. And what I want to shift our focus on of what it means to gather meaningfully is how do you actually gather in a way that creates meaning for people? I was talking with a woman recently who's a writer, and she wanted to host a dinner party. And I said, it's not about the setting or what you're going to cook. I said, so here's the question. First of all, every gathering should have a purpose, even if the purpose is not serious. You have to know why you want to bring people together, because it'll help you figure out who you want to bring together. Mm-hmm. And she said, I'm a worn out mom. And I realized this a couple of days ago. I was at a friend's house, and she cut me a peanut butter and jelly sandwich into triangles and fed me baby carrot sticks, and I burst into tears. And I said, why did you burst into tears? And she said, because I realized that I'm really tired. I'm a worn-out mom. I said, great, build on that. And she said, what if I hosted a dinner party for my other worn-out moms, where we all just took care of ourselves and each other for the night? I said, great. Give it a name. And she called it the Worn Out Moms Hootin' Nanny.
Oh, I love it.
And I said, give it a rule. And she said, if you talk about your kids, you have to take a shot. All six women RSVP'd yes within the hour. Not every gathering has to be, you know, you bearing your soul. To create more meaningful gatherings, one very simple example is create a moment of focus at your gathering where you're giving people context and meaning as to why they're there. So, for example, a summer barbecue. A new couple moves into a neighborhood. They want to invite their neighbors over. People come for the barbecue. Everyone has a good time for 2 hours and they leave. So how do you actually increase the meaning factor? About an hour in, ding your glass or however, you know, culturally appropriate feels good to you. Raise a glass and say, hey, something like, and that should be true to you. Hey, we just want to thank you all for coming. We moved here recently. This is the first home we've ever bought. It's been a long time coming. We want to build our family here. And we each grew up on a neighborhood block where neighbors borrowed sugar from each other. And we're really excited to be part of this block and hope that we will be borrowing sugar from each other for the next 20 years. Tears.
Tears. Oh, that's a great idea. So Priya, you talk about excluding well in gatherings. How can we do this and not feel like we're part of a middle school clique?
Great question. To begin to exclude based on purpose, not based on the person. What I mean by that is when our gatherings tend to be diffuse and diluted in that we don't actually know why we're gathering. We're just following a form. So for a wedding, people think it's obvious why one is having a wedding. And so the first step to gathering more meaningfully is to first pause and say, what is the purpose of this gathering? What is the need? Why am I actually bringing a specific group of people together? And for a wedding, is this to honor your parents? Is this to unite a new tribe? Is this to bring together people who would never again be in the same room and create an experience for them so that when the going gets tough, they actually do feel a stake in our marriage? Those are very different purposes. But because we don't pause to ask, it usually happens through proxy war, meaning a fight over the guest list or a fight over the size. Should I invite my mother's colleague for that last seat or my college buddy? And when you start arguing about it, what you're implicitly arguing about is who is this for first, right? What is this wedding about? And when you start with purpose and you get clear on it, it's much easier to exclude rather than saying, hey, let's have a get-together. Who should we invite? And then start realizing, well, so-and-so is connected to so-and-so, so we can't invite him without inviting her. So-and-so is going to find out because of such-and-such. And then it basically becomes, you know, a game of sort of social engineering to avoid offense,
right,
which
right.
is not usually lead to an inspiring gathering. And so the first thing is the clearer you are on this purpose, the easier it is to justify exclusion. The more is not always the merrier. The more is often the hairier or the scarier.
So, okay, I am thinking of having a 50th birthday party coming up mm-hmm. this year. Give me your advice about something like that.
I would think almost of your 50th birthday party as an excuse.
Yeah.
As a powerful excuse that people are willing to get on a plane for.
Right.
Or go the extra mile to, like, get a babysitter or whatever the thing that if it was just a regular, you know, day or regular birthday, they may not. And I would first ask you the question I ask everybody, which is when you think about this moment right now in your life, you're turning 50, what is it that you most need? When you think about kind of the next decade, what is it that you want to be set up for? What is it that you are actually wanting to mark?
Those are great questions. I'll have to think about that.
And I don't know you, you know, from Adam, but so let's play with this a bit. So say it's the last 10 years have been about hunkering down and building my professional life. And I want the next 10 years to be about expansion and reigniting adventure.
That sounds great. Yes.
So say, okay, so if it's about expansion and reigniting adventure, put that in some form in the invitation, in part because it helps create a context and a meaning for everybody else. Oh, I should bring my adventurous side. Oh, I want to be expansive too. You know, I was at a 50th birthday party a few years ago where somebody said, 50 is an interesting year, and 60 even more so. And I watch my friends, there is a natural instinct to go in, to get smaller. And there are a few people in my life that I've watched when they're 50 or 60, they expand. Mm-hmm. And everybody in this room are people who, wherever you are in life, you've always embodied and symbolized to me expansion.
That's a wonderful thought. Yeah.
It's an orienting principle of who do I want there versus just like having a container and have everybody come to a dance floor and, you know, have a big party. That's fine. But what I'm actually talking about is dialing up the meaning so that you're actually gathering around a real need in your life and that people feel like, wow, they actually need me to help fulfill that.
Well, as you're talking about it, I'm thinking about it. It's not, it is in part celebrating that birthday, but it's about celebrating the future too.
Maybe a 50th birthday party is everybody's running a half marathon, a renewal to reinvest in my body and I invite you to join too.
Oh, I love it. Yes,
right?
That's
it's
great.
Like, yeah. To break out of the box of thinking, what's the hall that I rent? What's the booze that I get? And what's the band that I book?
Right. It's just you go a little bit farther and then a little bit farther and then it starts to become clearer in a way.
One of the gatherers I most admire is a man named Theodore Zeldin, the philosopher. And he, every year for a number of years, he's now, I think, in his 80s, he would throw his birthday party. He'd advertise in the newspaper in London that he was going to throw a birthday party in a public park, come one, come all. And he called it a menu of conversations. Hmm. And in lieu of food, there would be tables all over, and thousands of people would show up. There would be a menu of conversation. And for the fish course, he would ask questions like, what is your relationship to money? Hmm. Or what have you rebelled against in the past? And what are you rebelling against now? And every course was a different set of questions in which he realized that in many cases, it's actually easier to tell a stranger something about yourself than it is a friend, in part because they have no stake in your life.
Right.
They have no stake in your past self or your future self. They are okay with you being full of paradoxes.
I love that. So are you hopeful that people are going to keep meeting together in these incredibly meaningful ways?
I think the verdict is out as to whether or not we shift the focus to creating meaning through the interaction of people. Mm-hmm. And the competition is stiff. The phones are addictive. Thousands of engineers are spending thousands of hours getting us to figure out how to spend more time in the boat of our email, right, or our social networking. So not only do we need to gather in person in order to improve our human connections to each other, our emotional intelligence, our sense of belonging, we better do it well. And so part of what I'm saying is don't gather more offline, gather more meaningfully. And if your in-person gatherings aren't meaningful, which studies show that many people are disappointed with their state of friendship, the average adult hasn't made a new friend in 5 years, the way we're gathering isn't necessarily working. Some of the gatherings are working, but how do we have a specific disputable purpose? How are we willing to share that we actually need one another? In our moments of life, in our moments of transition, whether it's your 50th birthday party or the death of a loved one or a graduating from college, how do we not just go on autopilot and repeat the form that we think is meaningful but actually feels kind of empty? But instead, how do we begin to invent modern ritual that achieves and addresses the actual moment that we are in?
Priya Parker is the author of The Art of Gathering, and she's the founder of Thrive Labs. Shannon Henry Kleiber talked with her. There's one kind of in-person get-together most of us take part in every week, whether we like it or not. The staff meeting. Recently, someone sneaky turned the mic on ours.
I have a suggestion that none of y'all will like.
Yeah, great.
I think that I should just clandestinely record you at a meeting of my choosing without telling you when I'm recording.
But the
I can see to it that one of my spies gets in here with a microphone.
That sounds scary, right?
We do laugh a lot in our meetings, so we get that right. But we're also sarcastic, argumentative, and nitpicky.
So I have two different. I have actually sort of a fairly strong opinion about this.
Really?
Just go ahead and share. I think the idea of this was this is the TT book alternative to light summer trashy reading.
I don't like calling any books trashy. Well,
we waste an unbelievable amount of time debating trivialities.
I don't get the whole notion of beach reading.
I think that sounds like a good show.
I agree.
And I would call them difficult summer beach books.
What?
Sometimes we sound downright clueless.
So when do we cut the voice tracks? I guess I need a calendar, I'll say.
Are we all here on the 24th?
I'm just looking at the date. That's a Monday?
I'm not
Monday.
Here.
Yeah, hold on.
That's a bad idea.
That's a typical TT Book staff meeting. I hope yours are better. But if not, here's someone to help.
If you just talk to people, you hear how often they say, oh my gosh, I went to a terrible meeting today. I sat through so many meetings. I had no time to get my work done because all I did was spend time in meetings. They permeate all aspects of work. And even the ones that we go to that maybe work gets done, they don't necessarily feel good while you're there.
Mamie Canfer-Stewart spends a lot of time in meetings, usually because she's been hired to try to improve them. She runs a training firm called Meteor and hosts the Modern Manager podcast. And Mamie says doing meetings wrong is not just a hassle. It drains companies of money and time. And it's a multi-billion dollar problem. Employees are now averaging about 6 hours of meetings a week, and managers up to 23 hours. One study estimates a third of those meetings are unnecessary. Just think about that. So this is purely anecdotal, but in my workplace, it seems like the number of meetings has just steadily increased over the last couple of decades to the point that we don't even have enough conference rooms anymore. I mean, some of our top managers, I think all they do is go to meetings. Is this true elsewhere? I mean, are we meeting more?
I think anecdotally, you're on the right path for a couple of reasons. First, the complexity of work has grown over the past decade, right? Work moves faster. There are more people involved. We are trying to be more networked in our organization. So meetings are a critical place where people come together to do that kind of work. So the fact that the work itself is evolving means that we need more meetings to address it. And as we have more and more remote teams and doing more client work or other things where people aren't co-located anymore, meetings become kind of a default mode for connecting because we're all so overwhelmed with email, we can't rely on it anymore. So we have more meetings to make up for the fact that we don't have other good communication methods.
So we're all spending more and more time in all of these meetings. And is it my imagination or does it seem like the purpose of meetings is getting muddier and muddier? I mean, sometimes it seems like we're meeting to meet.
That is definitely true. There are way too many meetings on the calendar with no clear purpose. And I've talked to team leaders who have inherited teams where they're told, we have our weekly team meetings on Mondays, and the new team leader comes in and they just take over those weekly team meetings on Mondays. And then I talk to them after a couple of months and they say, these meetings are terrible. I don't know why we're having them. And I say, you're the team leader. Why are you having them? Think about what you need to get out of a team meeting. And if this design isn't working, change the design. And if you don't need it, cancel it.
I'm going to tell you a secret, which obviously is not a secret since I'm saying it on public radio, but our little tiny team, on to the best of our knowledge, they're just 7 of us. When the EP, Steve, is gone, we usually cancel the staff meeting.
That is a surprisingly common thing that happens too, because a lot of team meetings are really designed for the team leader who feels like they need to be knowing what's going on with all the different people. They need to bring the team together so there's at least one time where everybody's kind of in the same room together for good team building and morale and connection. But then when that team leader isn't there, the rest of the team doesn't have those same needs. They don't feel the need to get into a room just to be together, and they don't often care about what the other people are working on. And if they did care, there are other ways that they will communicate that.
I think meetings can go badly in like a million ways, probably. But can we just compare a few pet peeves? I'll tell you what I hate, if you tell me what you hate.
Absolutely.
Okay, so I hate PowerPoint presentations, especially where the presenter stands there and reads what we can all see on the screen.
Yes. Can I give a little mathematical model on that one?
Yeah.
So if you have 10 people coming to your meeting, and that's a big meeting, but if you had 10 people, just make the math easy. If everyone were going to speak equally, you would get 6 minutes per person. Now, if you take those same 10 people and you spend the first half an hour presenting your slide deck that everyone could have read earlier or could read in 5 minutes if you just gave it to them at the meeting, you have now gone from 6 minutes of people's thinking to 3 minutes of people's thinking. Why are you taking an hour to get 3 minutes of somebody's thinking? That is the biggest waste.
Yep. Why do you think we're so bad at something we do all the time?
Yeah, well, the problem with meetings is We are expected to know how to do them. And so admitting that you don't is like admitting that you don't know how to do your job, especially as a manager, because so much of your job is having meetings. We're not taught this. Nowhere in life are we taught how to gather people. Even in business school, it should be a course, how to have meetings, how to use meetings to get work done.
Isn't it? I guess I thought that's what people learn in business school.
I wish I went to business school. I did not learn that.
Huh. What's at stake when an organization isn't doing meetings well?
So much is at stake. When you walk out of a meeting and you don't feel excited to go about your day, that just influences all the other work that you're going to get done. So there's a whole element of lost productivity that happens. Then there's the human toll, right? If people don't feel good about going to work because they're not excited to go sit through a whole day of meetings, or they know they're going to have to stay late to make up all the tasks they didn't have time for, that takes a toll on your workforce. People will eventually leave because they don't want to put up with it anymore. There's a lack of communication that happens, right? If you're relying on meetings for too many things, then people who aren't in the meetings don't know what's going on, and you create this culture of FOMO. Then you make more people want to come to the meetings, which only leads to more unproductive meetings that they don't really need to be in, but they want to be there because they think that's the place to be. So it becomes this negative spiral that impacts and permeates all aspects of the organization.
You also are big on people having a checklist before you even have a meeting. Can you run us through that?
Sure. We often jump to meetings as the next step. So I'm facing a problem. Let's have a meeting. Wrong approach. I'm facing a problem. Okay, let me figure out what I need. Am I clear about the problem? Yes. Okay. Do I need other people to help me solve it? Do I need them together all at the same time? Or can I share something with a bunch of people individually and just get their input? So that's kind of the first part around, do you have a meeting or not? But then the second part is when you have a meeting, once the meeting is scheduled, a meeting doesn't just start when the clock hits that time. The meeting starts before. There's actually a cycle. There's the before, during, and after of every meeting. And the before has a whole bunch of preparation that you need to do as the meeting leader and that the participants can do so that everybody walks in, right? If everybody's owning the success of the meeting, everybody needs to walk in prepared, not just the meeting leader.
So can I ask you about my own little tiny, to the best of our knowledge, staff? Because we have what I think of as extremely talkative meetings. We're in radio. But often we have these meetings. They're really great. We generate 100 ideas and we leave and it's like, now what?
Yeah. So now we're talking about the end of the meeting, right? So it's very easy to answer the question, why? Why are we having this meeting? To review last quarter's performance, to check in on the project status. But at the end of the meeting, how will you know it's successful? What will we achieve after having reviewed the results or checked in on something? It's the noun. So at the end of the meeting, we will have a list of changes to next quarter's plan. At the end of the meeting, we will have 3 new ideas to experiment with on our social media platform.
So when it all goes well, when you've developed purposeful, joyful meetings, what do you think we get by meeting in person that we don't in other ways?
There's nothing that substitutes for a face-to-face conversation. We get to see the full expression of someone's body language and their tone of voice and look them in the eye, right? Those things cannot be replicated. Seeing somebody on a tiny video screen or even a big video screen, it's just not the same. You can't connect in the same human way as you can when you're sitting face to face with someone.
Good advice. Thank you so much for talking today.
Sure. I just want to throw this out there. One thing we didn't talk about was meeting wrap-ups and how to end your meeting strong. That's often what I get asked about.
Well, obviously, I'm not good at that since I just ended without wrapping up. So. No, tell me about the end of a meeting.
Ending your meeting is just as important as how you start it. Because when people dissipate out of a meeting, right, you're running right up to the deadline of time and people are like, oh, I have another meeting to go to, you know, and they run out the door. That is very unsatisfying. It does not feel like the conversation was productive, even if it was a great conversation. So using the last 5 minutes and reserving them for a wrap-up can really change the quality of the meeting experience and help you articulate the outcomes of that meeting. And the easiest way to start doing a wrap-up is to just ask the group, what did we decide in this meeting? What are our decisions that we made? What are the next steps and who's going to do what? And who's going to do what by when, even better? And is there any other information that we need to share with people? Type that up real time as people are going around in the circle and then hit send on the email right then and there so there's no extra work to do. And when you do that, it gives people that sense of closure.
That's really nice. This is going to seem strange, but it sort of reminds me of a church service. You know, by the time you're done and there's the last prayer and the last song and then you walk out, there is a feeling of like, yeah, closure. We did something.
Exactly.
Mamie Canfort Stewart's guide to better meetings is called Momentum. She also hosts the Modern Manager podcast. So what else do we miss when we don't meet in person? For one thing, the social bonds that create change.
Do you choose box number one?
Producer Angelo Bautista introduces us to a club full of people who watch RuPaul's Drag Race together next. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Some things are just better when you're hanging out with your friends, not online, but in real life. Like even watching TV. Here in our office, Angelo Bautista has been talking about a friend group that he's been missing lately. So, Angelo, you were telling me about one of your and your friends' traditions that's changed recently.
Yeah, so when I was in college, every Thursday night, my friends and I, we would go out to our favorite gay bar, the only gay bar in town, the back door, to watch RuPaul's Drag Race.
Receives a one-year supply of Anastasia Beverly Hills cosmetics and a cash prize of $100,000.
Okay, here, I have to confess that I've never actually watched Drag Race. Can you give me Drag Race 101?
Okay, so for the uninitiated, Drag Race is basically Project Runway meets America's Next Top Model, meets Real Housewives, meets Survivor, meets Lip Sync Battle, but with drag queens.
I'm gonna ride this unicorn down to the final four.
You've lost me, but okay, why have you been thinking about it now?
So my friends and I, we all live in different states now. But we do watch together, though, virtually. We have this group chat, and we'll all watch Drag Race at the same time. For me, it's by myself in my empty apartment on my laptop.
What does that sound like?
Okay, so these are my friends.
Brooklyn Heights is going to win this season, yes?
I want Banshee. Or Miss Evie.
There is so much drama this season. IDK if I can handle it anymore.
I do not care for Russia.
But of course, she's a villain.
This is a pretty weak runway, IMO.
The other week, we were watching the last episode before the finale. I'm sitting at my dining table, sipping a LaCroix, laptop at the ready. The group chat was quiet because Katie's in Russia visiting family, and Sophia was out at a bar with her new Atlanta friends.
Okay, so we're at Mary's on a Thursday night. It's about 8:50, so 10 minutes to Drag Race. I'm with my friends, Josh and Kayla.
Hi.
Hey.
Hearing Sophia have fun with her new friends, I couldn't help but feel a little bummed, left out. But then I thought, well, why does it matter who's with me? I mean, we are all watching the same show together, right? Suddenly, watching Drag Race alone, I felt like I'm missing something. So I wanted to go find that magic again. This is Prism, Madison's premier inclusive nightclub. Tonight's the grand finale of season 11. People are sitting around the bar like it's an episode of Cheers. That is, if the bar in Cheers was lit up with rainbow lights. It feels a little like walking into the cafeteria on the first day of school, and I don't know where to sit. But it's obvious what we're all doing here.
Because of you, our little drag show has become a cultural phenomenon.
Tonight, the top four queens, Akiria Davenport, Silky Nutmeg Ganache, Brooklyn Heights, and Evie Oddly lip sync for the crown. And everyone has someone they're rooting for.
That's right. Two by two, they will face off and lip sync the house down.
I'm Eric.
Hi, Eric.
And I'm Hannah.
Hannah, hi. Do you guys come here often to watch Drag Race?
This is my first time here for Drag Race.
Oh, really?
Specifically, yeah.
Mine too.
Oh, nice.
What about you?
Yeah, this is my first time here.
How do you normally watch Drag Race?
I either watch it in my apartment or at Hannah's apartment.
So how is that different from, like, watching it in a bar?
I like the, like, community feeling of this, being around other people. I'm excited to see who's also, like, rooting for Evie tonight.
So you're Team Evie?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, me too, full disclosure. Going into tonight, I think a lot of people expect Evie to make it to the final lip sync. She's an oddball for sure, rough around the edges, but always avant-garde, conceptual, out of the box. On the show, she dressed as a giant jellyfish, a lion made out of computer parts, and a three-eyed, three-boobed red velvet opera singer. The only one I can see beating her is Brooklyn Heights. She won the most challenges this season, and she's kind of the opposite of Evie. Brooke is a polished, mega-talented ballerina who does her lip syncs while dancing on point. Hard to beat.
How do you plan to come out on top tonight?
Do you mean besides the loose pearls and razor blades?
Yes, besides all of that, yes.
Over in the corner, there's a group of guys, and they look really close-knit. They all kind of look alike, too, with their tight-fade haircuts and patterned button-ups. Can you tell me your name?
Thomas.
Hi, Thomas. I'm Angelo. How long have you been coming here?
Probably about 4 years.
Oh, wow. Okay, so do you ever watch just, like, at home?
Occasionally, I'll watch it back at home.
Okay, so what's the difference, then, between watching at home and watching here?
It's really kind of magical to be in a queer space with other queer people watching something queer and to all have this big, like, guttural reaction over, like, a lip sync or a reveal or something like that. It's like our Super Bowl, so it's, like, really exciting for us all together and, like, having that reaction with each other and then talking about it during the commercial break and running to the bathroom to get back to talk about it and just react about it in the moment with someone is really great.
To be perfectly honest, I'm feeling a little jealous of Thomas right now. I haven't really had a gaggle of gay friends to hang out and watch Drag Race with since I moved here. But not everyone's here with their gaggle. One guy's here with, I think those are his parents?
Yes, these are my parents.
Okay, so how long have you guys been coming here to watch Drag Race?
This is all of our first time.
Okay, okay. So have you seen the show before?
I have not, but I would love to see it again.
What do you think so far?
Not sure who I'm voting for yet until I see all four of them up there.
What about you? What do you think so far?
It's interesting. Yeah, they're all competing, and obviously you got to wait and see what the four of them do. So which one you would vote for, I have no idea. But, you know, all you can do is watch and laugh and enjoy.
I love that you guys think you can vote because you have no say in this.
Well, I know.
I mean, who we...
We vote.
We want who we vote. Hopefully,
got
to win.
An opinion, honey.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're entitled to an opinion. So whatever happens, I don't know, but we'll see.
So, by the way, hi. My name's Angelo. What's yours?
Chrissy.
Hi, Chrissy. So you were the one responsible for bringing these two ladies with you to Drag Race.
These two ladies, and I've been bringing anybody I can find to Drag Race since it started.
Oh my gosh, really? Like, since, what was the first season you watched?
One.
Oh, really? I've never even seen that one.
Angina.
Oh, wow. So you've been watching for a while. Do you get Drag Race fatigue at all?
Oh, God, no.
Oh, really?
No. No, I'll watch this until they stop playing it, yes.
Oh, I know. I know Rue's going to keep on going till, like, we're season 17, All-Stars season 9.
Dear God, I hope so. And then once Rue is gone, I hope she passes the torch, because I'll be watching this until I hope my daughter can watch it with me.
That was close.
No, no, God,
the winner, tonight's first lip sync,
revealed after this brief...
I do see one girl standing off to the side. She's got these big glasses, she's texting on her phone, and she's drinking a beer by herself. Her name's Sarah.
So, is this your first time here, then, for Drag Race? Like, watching it here?
Yeah, this is the first time I've actually come here to watch it. Tonight I was like, no, I have to go in, otherwise I'm going to get all the spoilers on Reddit or all over social media, so I wanted to come in and watch it live. I'm actually texting with my friend who's in New York right now about Drag Race.
Are they watching it too?
Yeah, he's watching it too right now. So we're giving each other live updates.
Who are you rooting for?
I'm rooting for Evie. I had a soft spot for Akiria, but I sort of had a feeling she wasn't going to be popular enough to win. But I want her for president in 2020, so...
So it's time for the final lip sync, and it's Brooklyn versus Evie.
Good luck. And don't f it up. There ain't a reason you and me should be alone
tonight. Yeah, baby, tonight. Yeah, baby. Evie's wearing this billowing ball gown and this amazing headdress made out of mirrors that makes it look like she's a three-headed demon goddess. Brooklyn is covered in this huge black cape. Brooke twirls it off and reveals a catsuit covered in mirror shards. She's flying all over the stage, doing spins and high kicks, splits and headstands. But then, Evie turns around and reveals a bejeweled head with glowing red eyes. She does her signature backbend kickover, and everyone goes nuts. Maybe it's just because the song always gets me, but I started to feel really emotional. You know, seeing everyone smiling up at the screen and screaming their heads off, I couldn't help but smile too. I thought about how it's not just Prism, but gay bars across the country where everyone is cheering and clapping and hugging their friends. It felt so big. Fifty years ago, our ancestors rioted at the Stonewall Inn for the right to even be gay together in a bar. And here we are, about to crown a queen.
Winner, RuPaul's Drag Race. America's next drag superstar is...
That's the grand finale of the 11th season of RuPaul's Drag Race. The show's won 3 consecutive Emmys. Thanks to producer Angelo Bautista for sharing it with us in person. We've been talking about the value of meeting face-to-face. Well, in South Africa, there's an entire philosophy of interconnectedness called Ubuntu, where your sense of self is defined by your relationships with other people. And this has very practical implications. For instance, for the millions of people who have been leaving the African countryside and moving to cities.
The first thing you do when you arrive in a city and you don't have a place, you go to your next cousin and you stay with him until you get a job, and then you can move on. In South Africa, they call it the black tax. You have a moral obligation to support those around you.
Seeing the world through our connections with others. After this. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. There's a beautiful philosophy in South Africa known as Ubuntu, which puts our connections with other people at the center of human life. It was used a lot by Nelson Mandela and by Archbishop Desmond Tutu, but the concept itself goes way back, in South Africa and also in parts of Central and East Africa. James Ogude is a Kenyan-born literary scholar who's written several books about Ubuntu, and Steve and I caught up with him at a recent humanities conference in Ethiopia.
Ubuntu is a Southern African concept. What it means, Ubuntu, is rooted in what I call a relational form of personhood, meaning that you are because of the others in relation to other people.
So this is totally different than the Western notion of the self, which is rooted in individualism.
Yes, it is different. Although one needs to qualify that, you know, there's always this tendency when we talk about African communitarian ethos to argue that it deletes individuality. It doesn't. People will debate, people will disagree. It's not like there are no tensions. The myth that, you know, people share everything, they are no selfish people. No, that's not what communitarian ethos is. Yeah. It is basically about you come together as a community, build a consensus around what affects the community. And once you have debated and it is understood that this is the best for the community, then you have to buy into it.
Did you grow up with it in any way?
Look, some of these values, they're not written, but you feel them in your day-to-day practice. You are not just your father's child. You also belong to the community. When we were growing up, you could eat anywhere. You know, you go to the neighbor would take care of you if you're starving. If there's birth, a baby has been born, the whole community brings what they have. And people celebrate, you know, it's a way of affirming life.
And it also sounds like if then someone has trouble or a family has trouble, there's kind of the sense that the neighbors, the village, will pitch in and help.
Yeah, certainly, yeah. And without being idealistic, they are also deviant. You deviate from the norms of the society. For example, you're selfish. You get ostracized. People talk about you. They say, you know, so-and-so is very selfish. They even say, you know, this one is not a human being. And that extends even to animals, because the Ubuntu cosmology, especially among the Bantus, is about the totality. You've got a responsibility to the plants around you. You've got a responsibility to the animals around you. You've got a responsibility to the ancestors and, by extension, to the supreme being. That's why you sacrifice to the lakes.
What does that mean, to sacrifice to the lakes?
Basically, it's a source of life. It gives you fish. You are not allowed to engage in overfishing. If you caught too much, you're obliged to return some. And you pray to the lake gods or whatever to continue nourishing and giving people back life.
We've been talking about Ubuntu in sort of as a moral and ethical system, but I wonder if at a deeper, almost epistemological level, it's a different way of understanding what it means to be alive or to have a sense of self. I mean, I'm thinking about Descartes. I think, therefore I am.
I am, yeah.
This seems fundamentally different.
Different, yeah. Precisely. It is a major epistemological concept, radically very different from your Western idea of, you know, I think, so I am. And Ubuntu draws our attention to what I call the idea of co-agency, where you realize that interdependence is fundamental, you know, principle in life, as opposed to what we find in the West.
So can you give me some concrete examples of this sort of Ubuntu in practice?
Look at the South African context, where you emerge out of a totalitarian regime. A lot of injustice has been done. You enter this moment where you want to transform this society. And then you realize that the structures of justice are in themselves inadequate. They were crafted within the womb of that very authoritarian regime that you're talking about.
The whole legal system.
The whole legal system. So where do you start to bring a divided society together? Where do you start to bring a society that is emerging out of trauma and the traumatic conflict? And this is where the Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who was chairing the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, decides that there's a way in which we can dig into our culture and find something that will help us to bring about restoration, to bring about healing, a humanitarian value that transcends our differences, as it were. And then he decides that Ubuntu, and he combines it with what he calls the Christian, the Dei Imago theology, which basically says that we are all made in the image of God. So fundamentally, we are the same. Our differences are fictitious, are manufactured, and very much ideological. And that's when he came up, popularized the idea of Ubuntu.
So do you see the whole notion of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, I mean, how that played out in South Africa, that was very much rooted in an African sense of justice that would be very different than what might happen in the West?
Yes, it was, because your Western justice system is retributive. You bring the criminal there, he stands before a judge, and
he's found guilty
he's
or innocent.
Found guilty or innocent. If he's guilty, he's thrown in. But nothing happens to the victim. Nobody understands. In a way that also takes care of the victim and the perpetrator at the same time. Create a sense of dialogue. And this is what the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission was trying to do.
So this is a system and a philosophy that goes way, way back. So many cities in Africa now are really focused on a rush to become hyper-modern. Are you concerned at all about Ubuntu as a philosophy being forgotten, or do you feel like there's a way it could be revived and work in a kind of hyper-modern society?
Yeah, this is a very interesting and complex question, because one of the arguments that we have against Ubuntu, or many African values for that matter, is that in the post-colonial moment, we are cosmopolitan, the society has become increasingly very individualistic. You go into a city and it's a site of survival of the fittest. How do you survive? And yet, to the contrary, one of the most fascinating things, the way that they reproduce some of these networks of support. They come from farm, they move into the city of Ethiopia or Johannesburg or Nairobi, and they realize this acute sense of alienation. So what do? You build a network of support among yourselves, so that the first thing you do when you arrive in a city and you don't have a place, you go to your next cousin and you stay with him until you get a job, and then you can move on. In South Africa, they call it the black tax, that we always have this responsibility to our siblings. You finish the university and you have to educate your cousins, not just your brothers, but you also educate your cousins. So these networks persist, and they persist precisely because of the awareness of our interdependence, the awareness that you have a moral obligation to support those around you.
So we've been talking about Ubuntu kind of as a philosophical idea and sort of how it plays out in various communities. Mm. I'm wondering how this plays out in your own life. I mean, are there sort of specific things that have happened to you or choices that you make that you do because of this tradition of Ubuntu?
Not so much because I had Ubuntu as a concept at the back of my mind, but because I was brought up in a network where I was supported by others. I was sent to school by my brother. My father passed away when I was in standard 5. And it's my brother that took the responsibility to send me to school.
What did your brother do?
He moved me away from the rural area and took me to the city where I was staying, paid for me fees in a private school, which is a lot of money to be paid monthly. And I always look back and say that if it was not for his intervention, perhaps I would just be some hard boy around the village, you know, looking after cows and being paid and doing manual work. But that also meant that I also had a responsibility. So I've had to also educate those around me, my brother's kids, my sister's kids. In fact, at one moment in Johannesburg, I was staying with seven teenagers going to the university, because I went to South Africa, saw the opportunity because the South African education system was good, especially postgraduate. And I said, okay, I'll also support them. So I started bringing them over. But it did not end with my own family. So I decided that I will start recruiting students from Kenya, from Nigeria, from Uganda, a whole lot of them. I see that as an expression of Ubuntu in certain ways. And some of them would come, you know, stay with me for 2-3 weeks before they settle down. These are things that you kind of internalize as you grow up. You see that people have supported you and you also have to give back.
Steve Paulson and I talked with James Ogude at the first African Humanities Workshop at the University of Addis Ababa in Ethiopia. It was sponsored by CHCI, the Consortium of Humanities Centers and Institutes. We're partnering with them to bring you an ongoing series of ideas from Africa. For more about Ubuntu, decolonizing the mind, and James Ogude's personal story, you can find background and a transcript of our full conversation online. Look for the link at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison, Wisconsin. We would love to hear your stories about gatherings, whether they were terrible or wonderful. You can record your story at ttbook.org/gathering. This hour was produced by Shannon Henry Kleiber, with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Mark Rickers, and Angelo Bautista. Joe Hartke is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Anne Strainchamps. Thanks to you for listening.